This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. One morning earlier this week, as I was trying to get out the door to come to work, I noticed that my son was being very quiet over in the corner. I hustled over and discovered that he was happily stuffing pieces of dog food into his tiny mouth. "Please stop eating the dog food," I told him, as if a one-year-old can be reasoned with. "You'll choke on it, and it's really gross." It would have been comical, and it was actually comical, but I was late to work. I had already changed outfits after being spit up on. I had a big day ahead of me, and I still hadn't figured out how we were going to manage an upcoming closure at his daycare, a daycare that is only marginally less expensive than our monthly mortgage. So I scooped him up, tickling his belly, reserved my snappy tone for my husband probably, and shuffled out the car to the car, laden down with kid stuff and work stuff, hours into my day and already frazzled and tired. I tell you this not to whine, I know how lucky I am, but to commiserate with other parents in the understanding that this stuff is hard. It's hard to figure out how to balance work and relationships and parenthood. I want to do my best at work, but I also want to be a good mom, and oh yeah, I'd like to be able to go for a run by myself once in a while, and let's not even talk about sleep. There aren't enough hours in the day or dollars in the bank for most middle-class parents to feel like they can fit it all in. Add a heavy dose of guilt, work guilt, relationship guilt, parenthood guilt, and it can be really difficult for parents to say that they're having fun. Which is not to say there aren't moments of fun or a deep sense of joy and fulfillment and yes, even happiness. But parenting is among the many things we do that is hard. In her new book, All Joy and No Fun, journalist Jennifer Senior explores why it's so hard. She looks not at how best to raise children, but at how children affect their parents, how kids reshape their parents' lives just as parents are trying to mold their offspring. And she explores how our modern society and culture contributes to the particular stresses of parenthood, from when their offspring are babies until they're teenagers. Jen Senior lives part-time in Woodstock, Vermont, and she joins us today to dissect some of those factors. Jen, what a pleasure to have you on Vermont Edition.
Oh my God, you know I'm a huge fangirl. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
And I'm sorry to hear that you are sick today, but we're so glad that you made the effort still to speak with us. We'll try not to make you talk too much.
Oh, thank you. No, it's fine. When I left my house, it sounded like a consumption ward. It was like Bellevue in the 1900s. It was pathetic. So anyway, it's going around, so it's fine.
So you say in your book that parenthood is fun. Frequently, it's a lot of fun, and there is joy in raising kids, but it's those day-to-day details that can be really hard. And whether it's figuring out if one parent stays home while the other works, or trying to pay for daycare while two parents work, or being a single parent where the whole burden falls on you of parenting and financing and logistics, those things are often not just not fun, but detrimental to parents' well-being. Can you talk a little bit about how?
Yes. I mean, here's what's interesting. The data speaks very clearly about this. What first turned me on to this topic was I was doing a social science story for New York Magazine and discovered along the way that one of the most robust findings in social science is that parents are not as happy as non-parents, which at the time blew my mind because I didn't have a baby then and all I wanted was a baby. That was all I wanted. But once I had a baby, I, of course, thought, well, I have to interrogate this data. That is so interesting, and it is so robust, because there's tons of it out there. And it turns out that, yeah, it's not that kids are the problem. It's, as you were pointing out, you were going through this long list, it's something about raising kids right now in 2015 that's intensely problematic. A lot about our parenting lives has really, really changed. So, I mean, I could go piece by piece and tell you, you know, the various things that sort of compromise a parent's well-being, whether it be financial stress or whether it be contending with the kinds of new choices that we have or the fact that we live in a culture that is completely unaccustomed to women working, even though 4 in 10 mothers are now the primary, if not sole breadwinners in their families. We're not used to the fact that our kids no longer work for us. You know, they used to be our employees. I mean, we're not used to anything. So, I mean, I could bend your ear for hours about this, basically.
Well, you quote in your book, you say the modern child is economically worthless but emotionally priceless to parents.
Yeah. Now, that is a ruthless observation in its way. It's very spare. It was done by a woman named Viviana Zelzer, a sociologist, and it captured something essential. Here is what she noticed. right until the Progressive Era, kids were economic assets to their families. And in general, the more you had, the better off your family was. They worked on our farms, they worked in factories, they worked in mills, they worked in mines, they worked in the street trades. And I am not for 10 seconds saying that this was ethical, or that I pine for the Dickensian days of yore when children were working, but it was helpful to the family, right? They contributed. Somewhere in the Progressive Era, so let's say between 1890 and 1920, we banned child labor. And by post-World War II, let's say, we were almost working for them. Kids had gone from being economic assets to economic drains on the family. They started to cost the family. They were taking money from the family till. And what we decided instead is that they were exceptionally precious. They were invaluable. And we got very, very sentimental about them. And it seems hard. I mean, we, of course, always loved our children. But when we were having 13 of them and only four were surviving into adulthood, we didn't obviously sort of assign the same sentimental value to them. And also, they were, again, working for us. So it was this enormous shift, which sounds, again, very cold, but is in fact kind of a brutal reality.
We're talking with Jennifer Senior. She's the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And she's helping explore why modern factors have coalesced to make parenthood perhaps even harder than it was in the past. It's always been a hard thing for parents, but maybe harder now, maybe made just a little bit less fun. There's a lot going on for parents. And we'd love to hear from you if you are one or if you know one and would like to share a story with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tell us about how you think about balancing work and relationships and your own sense of self along with parenthood. What are your biggest challenges? Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. And Jen, we should point out, you do in your book, that your reporting is specifically directed at middle-class parents, not the very rich who have a lot of resources at their disposal, nor the very poor who have significantly less resources and a lot more stress than simply parenting.
Exactly. And thank you for bringing that up. I feel like it's so important to say. Right. The very rich, yeah. I mean, they're sort of outliers in their own way. As you say, they have lots of resources they can throw at child care and all sorts of, you know, kind of difficulties that I think the middle class, the middle of the middle class faces. Poor parents, it was with some sadness that I didn't figure out a way to address this. But the problem is that the problems of poverty and the problems of parenting are hard to separate when you're sort of examining that closely, what's going on. If you are a mom who has a minimum wage job and it takes you 2.5 hours to get there on a bus and you don't have health care and you don't have any place to put your kid, is that a poverty problem or a parenting problem? I mean, it's very clearly both, right? So I couldn't really string apart one from the other. And I think that many books should be dedicated entirely to that, you know, and it was beyond the scope of my own book.
You mentioned a minute ago that it's not necessarily the kids that make parenthood so tricky and frustrating and often emotionally difficult for parents, but you also write that when parents are asked what activities they want to be doing, it's not necessarily spending time with their kids, even if they love their kids. Parents would rank housework above childcare when they talk about what they think is a fun time to be doing activities.
Okay, so a note about the design of that study. They weren't consciously saying that, and that is in some ways the essential difference, or the essential distinction here. So you're citing a very, very, very famous study by Daniel Kahneman and his colleagues. Daniel Kahneman, I'm sure many of your listeners know him. He won a Nobel Prize for basically inventing the field of behavioral economics. He wrote Thinking Fast and Slow. He asked 909 working women in Texas to do two things. They had to say what they did the day before and write how much they liked doing it, whatever they were doing. And unbeknownst to them, when they tallied up all the results, it turned out that these women had rated childcare 16 out of 19 in terms of pleasurability. So it wasn't that they were going, huh, I think I would prefer, vacuuming to hanging out with my kid. It just turns out that that day when they said, oh, I hung out with my son for 2 hours, how did I like it? Oh, it was pretty lousy, actually. The kid was crying and complaining the whole time. Whereas when they were doing the dishes, like, it was fine. They were spacing out, it was neutral. It was neither here nor there. So what's interesting is that unwittingly, when parents are asked to evaluate the time that they spend with their children, they wind up kind of noting that it's rather stressful time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he found out. But if you ask any parent just to reflect on what they think gives them the most pleasure, they're always going to say their kids. All they have to do is think about it in some larger way, where you're not evaluating moment-to-moment happiness, but just thinking about what feels right to you, essentially right in the core of who you are. It's your kids. It's always your kids.
Well, and particularly for working parents, that idea of spending so much time away from your kids, and you think about the time that you could spend with your kids and how valuable that is. But then when you're actually with your children, you talk a little bit about how big a factor boredom is, that some of the tasks, especially with small children, are not exactly scintillating for adults.
And this is a source of shame for a lot of parents. I think parents have great difficulty discussing boredom. I know that I would see parents kind of seize up. They would be very open and kind of just talking at length about things that gave them much pleasure and gave them much distress. And then the subject of boredom would come up and they'd kind of clamp up. But then they would, of course, start to allow that, in fact, there are only so many times that you can play My Little Pony or whatever it is, And here is what I would say about boredom. Even Dr. Spock talked about this. In the 1960s. He has this wonderful line that I'm not going to remember exactly, but it was something like, nature probably never intended the relationship between mother and child to be quite so exclusive. That it was perfectly reasonable for mothers who might have had a rich and rewarding life at an office. This is the 60s. Women were still pouring into, were starting to pour into the workforce, not in huge numbers yet, but they were there. He was saying, especially for women who had sort of enjoyed the pleasures of adult company, spending time with a child can be hard. And he didn't mention it once. He mentioned it a lot. I mean, boredom comes up in Spock. So everybody should take some heart in that.
We're talking today about parenthood and what it feels like and why it can be difficult and what actual factors in our society go into making it increasingly difficult for some parents. And we're also getting some notes from you about how you think about parenthood, how you think about yourself in relation to your kids. We got a note from Jordan in Charlotte who says, I've been a stay-at-home dad for over 5 years now, and it has been far from easy. I was laid off just 2 weeks after our first son was born. Our other son arrived 19 months after the first. They're both energetic and strong-willed, and though there are many days that I wish I was back in the workforce, there are many more where I'm so thankful for the gift that I've been given and the time I get to spend with our boys. Mark posted this note on how his children come up with incredibly insightful and sometimes off-the-wall comments that will stick with him his whole life. He writes in part, my wife and I celebrated our 10th wedding anniversary recently. Regarding our plan to celebrate, my 4-year-old daughter said to me, I wasn't there for your first wedding, but I know in my heart that I loved it. There could not have been a more loving thing said, Mark writes. And let's go to Beth, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Beth. You're on.
Hi, Jane. It's nice to hear about your baby boy.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to tell you, too, about this young woman that when I go to work, I take the bus to a lot of my jobs, and she has 4 very young children. Her oldest one is probably 8 years old, and she has a baby who's about 6 months old, and they get on the bus. They are adorable children. They're well-behaved. And I just try to tell her every time I see her how cute they are and what a wonderful job she's doing, because you can tell she's a little tightly wound. She's a person who doesn't realize what a wonderful job she's doing. So I just had to tell you about her.
Oh, Beth, thanks for the call. I appreciate hearing that. And Jen, you don't spend a lot of time discussing this particularly in the book, but this idea of judgment from other parents, so not the judgment that we feel about ourselves, but feeling like you're judged by other parents or judged by society for the choices you make. And all you have to do is, you know, do a quick Google search or look at your social media feed. And there are things about, you know, should parents let their kids walk to the bus alone or walk downtown alone, or are they spending too much outside, or, you know, what this mom is doing wrong versus that mom. And there's a lot of judgment out there. And Beth is trying to say, I just try to tell this woman she's doing a great job.
I know. I'm sort of welling up here. I mean, first of all, that's a lovely thing to say, Beth. And it's the kind of thing where mothers just don't get casual reinforcement like that. You know, they just don't. So what a, you know, gift to have done that. So in terms of judgment from other parents, the other day I tweeted, ladies, for the love of God, stop looking at Pinterest. You know, I was just so fed up. I mean, I think that people are really cowed by a lot of these social media sites. And Facebook, too, which no one seems to remember, is very aggressively curated, right, to show the best sides of your family. I mean, you can see just this plague of perfect pictures from friends of yours or high school friends, and then, them and their families. And then 2 months later, you'll see in their status update that they're divorcing or whatever. You know, I mean, you never really know what's going on. But in terms of the judgment, there's one thing that I think is very worth noting. I think it was the developmental psychologist Jerome Kagan who noted this a couple decades ago already. He was writing in the New Republic, and he said that being a mother, being a parent, is one of the only kind of publicly moral acts. It's one of the ways that we try and get moral approbation now. You know, it used to be that we were civic leaders, that we contributed to, you know, we were volunteers. We did all these other things that showed our moral worth. And now we've transferred all of that energy into our parenting. It's like we think that that's where we should be getting the kind of stamp of approval from our peers. And I think that's really tough. And I'd rather see all of us go back to soup kitchens, frankly, you know, than kind of have so much invested in this kind of active parenting is performance art and how good we, you know, I mean, it's really, really hard. And everybody sort of makes judgment calls based on the idiosyncratic circumstances of their own families. And it's very hard to know. I mean, absent seeing a parent outright, you know, strike their kid, you know, which is obviously horrible, you know, it's very hard to know, like, sort of what's supposed to be bad and what's supposed to be good. I mean, there are some laws you absolutely can't run afoul of, but it's tough. It's just hard.
We're talking with Jennifer Senior, the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And as we're talking about this, Jen writes in the book that it's no surprise that a lot of the blogging sites, a lot of the parenting blogs are written by people with very small children and not so much with teenagers. And we're going to get into a little bit about why and why parenting teenagers is a whole other difficult thing on its own. And listeners, please share your stories of parenthood with us and how you grapple with trying to organize your life around your kids and including your kids and including a sense of self and hobbies, perhaps, if you have time for them. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Senior, the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She's giving us a sense of some of the ways American culture has changed the experience of parenting, and we're hearing from some of you about how you suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous childhood behavior and how you navigate that elusive work-life relationship balance. You can give us a call with your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. It is pervasive, so go right over to Facebook if you're there already. Go to our Facebook page. You can talk parenting. And let's hear from Scott, who's calling in from Burlington. Hey, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just thinking that this topic is fascinating. I'm a relatively new parent. My wife and I have a 2-year-old boy, and on one hand, it is just about the most awesome thing that's ever happened to me. On the other hand, oh man, is it stressful on the wallet, stressful on the schedules, and wow. But another interesting thing is, as parents, we are not helicopter parents, and we find ourselves almost helicoptering to avoid the cold, icy stares of other parents. That's just sort of my two cents. Fascinating stuff.
Scott, can you give me an example with your two-year-old of how you feel like you're being a helicopter even against your better judgment?
Yeah, absolutely. At playgroups or whatnot, we're fine if he eats dirt. I mean, that's totally fine. Or if he wants to climb on something that's, maybe a little bit shaky, we're fine with it. But, invariably, whether it's happening or not, I get the feeling like I'm getting a cold, icy stare, like I'm, a horrible parent. Oh, God, how can you let your kid eat dirt? I don't know.
Yeah, Scott, thank you. I appreciate hearing an example. It's helpful to know what you're dealing with and how that stresses you out. And, dirt eaters unite. Let's go to Catherine in Piermont, New Hampshire, and then, Jen, I'll let you jump in. Hi, sure. Catherine. You're on.
Yeah. I have a different viewpoint from some of your callers because I'm 79.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my three as a single parent. I raised them, and I was fortunate enough to be able to teach most of the time. And the big difference I see, the big striking difference, is that children today seem to need to be entertained. I didn't have that problem. Mine were brought up to entertain themselves. Plus, we did a lot of field trips, museum trips, and the camping trips and everything ourselves. But I see such a difference, and children are just so, just expect to be entertained. Parents expect to entertain them all the time. And it was so utterly different then. And this was also before car seats.
Yep.
Catherine, that's so interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Jen, you actually do write about that in the book, about this idea that, first of all, parents feel like they need to entertain and be with their children all the time. But then that experience of children not having to deal with boredom and then not having to find their way out of boredom.
Right, that they can't tolerate boredom as well as, you and I probably did when we were told if we were bored to go clean our room, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Mothers today spend more time with their kids than they did in the 1960s. And this includes women who are in the workforce. They spend two more hours per week with their kids. And there are a number of reasons for this. I think some of it is just that we feel this need to intensively cultivate our kids, right? That we feel like if they're going to get a toehold in the middle class, in the shrinking middle class, we've got to kind of cultivate them within an inch of their lives. We've got to shuttle them back and forth to soccer and chess and all the, and violin and everything that we do. But yes, also stimulating them. And by the way, there's a huge market of toys designed around this concept, right? That we are, there's toys for fine motor and gross motor, and moms need to know the difference and need to know how to kind of select these for their kids and then stimulate them in that way. I think mothers are also spending a lot of time with their kids because they're compensating. We're very unresolved about women working, right now. I think that, on the one hand, Americans think that women should have the right to choose a profession. But on the other hand, I just saw Pew said that 51% of all Americans also think women should be home full time. So I think what we do as a way to compensate, be home full time for the betterment of their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we do to compensate is we spend all this intensive time sort of entertaining them. Also, kids now are scheduled within an inch of their lives from the moment they go to preschool. Their preschools have 15-minute blocked, blocks of time all mapped out for them. It's circle time, then it's music time, then it's unstructured playtime for 15 minutes, which is bananas if you think about it. So that's what I would say, I think, about her call. And then the previous caller, I so wish I could be there with him so that we could have develop some kind of critical mass of non-helicoptering parents. I would point him to the old Sesame Street DVDs, the first episodes of Sesame Street, which now come with a warning label that say that those episodes are not appropriate for children to watch.
They do?
Yes, they do. And the reason, in part, the executives, at Children's Television Workshop were asked about this. One of the reasons they cited, one, is that kids were walking all over unprotected New York City infrastructure, and they shouldn't do that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to have to check those out too, because I mean, that's what those of us who are parents were probably watching. So, you
of
know,
course it is.
We
yes,
managed
it,
to survive.
Right, but now a Muppet comes out and tells you they're dangerous. I'm just telling you now.
We're talking with Jen Senior. She's the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. We have a lot of parents who want to chime in who are thinking about these things too. No surprise there. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And I want to get back into some of the questions and thoughts that listeners have. But Jennifer, I mentioned before our break, I promised that I would just briefly have you explain why, you know, parents with small children often do talk about parenting difficulties, behavioral difficulties their children are having. How do you potty train? How do you deal with a willful, obstinate child? And that sort of disappears when those kids are older for a couple of reasons. Partly because children who are teenagers have more autonomy and more of a sense of self and perhaps don't want to have their issues paraded out in front of all their parents' friends, but also because parents feel more, it's more of a reflection on them as people and on their morals and values.
That's exactly right. I think family life starts to look a little bit more like a Russian novel, you know, in the teen years. I mean, you've got real complexity and going on, you know, and I think that's the main reason that in my book, it's the only chapter is the adolescence chapter where I didn't use people's names, real names. Everywhere else I do. Because even the good kids are doing things that kind of blow their parents' doors off. Like, they can't believe it. I mean, a really, you know, you'll hear a parent of a really talented, terrific child tell you about, like, something utterly inane and kind of embarrassing they did. You know, getting arrested for, you know, egging a house or whatever. And this is a kid who's otherwise, you know, can play three instruments and goes to a top-flight competitive public high school in the city. I mean, all these things. And it's embarrassing for the kid. You don't want the kid walking around with a trail of, you know, misdemeanors in a book. And the parent felt like this had something to do with her, whereas, you know, I think parents of adolescents would be astonished to know just how common it is for even the best of children to act out in all sorts of imaginative and slightly inane ways.
Let's go to Heather, who's calling in from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Heather.
Hello. Thank you. I wanted to, this is a nice segue, because my question, my comment is more about the adolescent years and the challenges that many of us in our 40s are experiencing, where we did not grow up in the era of technology with the iPhones or smartphones. And the art of having conversations with your children who are teens is greatly challenged by the fact that most of their communication skills are based upon a lot of their social experiences with their peers using their texting. And just last evening, as an example, as we were at the dinner table trying to engage in a pretty significant conversation, meaningful conversation, it's almost like the ability to socially communicate in that kind of a forum is so foreign to children these days. And it's a real learning curve for the parents, where that was the only way that we learned back in the 70s and 80s, where mm-hmm. we were talking with each other, the eye contact, the ability to understand full sentences. And it's greatly concerning to see where that generation of children are going to go, given the framework that they're operating from on a daily basis.
Heather, thanks for that comment. I appreciate that. Jen, you also talk about the difficulties for parents in trying to figure out how to snoop or not snoop, or how to sort of police their kids on social media, because you can't do it passively. You're either snooping on their social media pages or looking at their phones and texts and pictures, or you're not. And that's a really difficult balance to strike too.
Yeah, it's a weird and eerie Rubicon to cross. You know, I mean, if I think about when I was a teenager, if my mom wanted to get a bead on what was going on in my life, she basically just had to stand outside my room and eavesdrop, right? She would hear who I was on the phone with. There might even be an annotated phone bill if it were like long distance or whatever. She could figure it out. She might also even have answered the phone. In fact, she probably would have, and said, oh, it's for you and it's so-and-so. So that was all taken care of. And she also knew what I was watching, because she would just walk through the den. And now, if parents want to learn about any of that, if they want any visibility at all into their kids' lives, they've got to make the active choice to snoop. And that's a very hard choice to make. And arguably is one that should be done because kids don't have terrific judgment at that age. You know, their prefrontal cortexes are not fully developed. They don't have full executive control over their judgment and their thinking. So it's not a bad idea. And speaking to your caller's observation, it is really hard, you know, to figure out the social aspect of this, especially because we're kind of guilty of the same thing as grownups. I mean, we're all off on our laptops, too, and we're all texting, too. You know, Sherry Turkle at MIT likes to say that just because we've grown up with the internet doesn't mean that the internet's all grown up. I think we're, you know, still working out etiquette for this.
And, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's go to Will, who's calling in from Manchester. Hi, Will. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I try to listen to this program as often as possible when it fits my schedule. And thank you, Jane, for this this specific topic because it drives right home to where I am at with my wife. We're two working parents with two children, a nine-month-old and a three-year-old. And we manage a crazy schedule, and we deal with daycare, drop-offs, and pickups, and the financial woes of trying to raise a child. And so this program in particular caused me to feel the need to voice my specific experience in that regard. I think if there's one generalization that I could make through this whole experience thus far, it's that I'm humbled by the ability of my wife to be able to take on the child rearing and do that while working at the same time. And I'm there to support as often as possible, but for some reason, the message is always sent back to me that there's this instinct that women have that they're so much more in tune with how to get ready for the trip to wherever, or what's going on tomorrow, or what's going on in a week, and is it tubby night or not, and I'm there to help, but for some reason I don't have the programming inside my brain to be able to lead the way that my wife and I think so many other women do.
Yeah, Will, thanks for your comment. I appreciate that. That's certainly a big part of Jennifer Senior's book, especially in those early chapters with young kids and figuring out the balance of household duties. I want to get another call in here because we're running short on time, but Jessica is calling in from Essex. Hi, Jessica. Your thoughts.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So, Jennifer, I love your work, and we have the book on our nightstand.
And, thank you. My publisher, thanks you.
My husband and I, when I had the baby, there was not a lot of time that I stayed at home. I entered grad school because I discovered that if I was at home, I was expected to be a full-time caregiver and homemaker, and I just couldn't do the homemaking part. And tenderly over the past year, we have an almost two-year-old as well. And over the past year, we've really figured out a balance that works well. And like half of the week, he's the one who brings the kid to daycare, and half of the week, I'm the one. And whoever's day she gets sick on, that's the person who leaves work. Mm-hmm. And we've actually divvied up our nights for meal preparations and divvied up the nights for baby put down and clean up. And
wow, Jessica really has it down, that balance that you have to strike with your spouse if you're lucky enough to have a partner that you're going through this with. I wish we could talk forever, but Jen, I know you have to catch a train, actually, to get to a reading tonight. And I want to tell people that, you know, some of the things that we didn't discuss in this book that I found particularly interesting, just the ways that your perception might change from what you would expect. Research shows dads feel more work-life conflict than mothers. Another change from the past, perhaps moms are the disciplinarians these days, more so than dads. I don't know whatever happened to wait till your father gets home. But that's not the situation in many modern households. Jennifer Senior, just, you know, a couple of seconds left here, but final thoughts for people who are navigating these murky waters of whatever age their kids are?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. When people tell you to enjoy these years because they go by so fast, gnash your teeth and smile and so know that sometimes it's going to be wonderful and it's okay if it's hard.
Jennifer Senior is the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, which I too had on my bookshelf for a year before I found the time to read it. lives part-time at Woodstock, Vermont, and her book has just come out in paperback. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I also want to mention that a listener named Harold emailed us with a parenting question, and this wasn't a show about parenting advice. So we've posted it on our Facebook page, and we would love if you could crowdsource some help for Harold. He's trying to figure out how to deal with his older daughter who's having some attitude problems now that she's a big sister. They have an 11-day-old child. So if you have advice for Harold, please go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and help him out. Coming up, a new photography exhibit at the Shelburne Museum. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Nathan Benn was a very young photographer in the early 1970s, he got an assignment from National Geographic to go shoot pictures of Vermont. When you look at those photographs now, they're so clearly from a different era. Many are unrecognizable as Vermont, even. They look like photos that could have been taken in the Depression. But they reveal a lot about a region that was right on the cusp of change, of modernization. Ben's photographs of Vermont and elsewhere are getting a special showing in a new exhibit at the Shelburne Museum. I got a preview from Shelburne Museum director Tom Denenberg and Nathan Benn himself.
Well, my picture of Vermont was formed based on an iconography that had been, you know, developing over 100 years of Yankee characters, flinty, thrifty, industrious Yankee characters, and, you know, fall foliage and clapboard churches with steeples.
Yeah. And Tom, what made you want to bring Nathan's photographs here? And this is, as I understand it, the first exhibit of these photographs that is going to go other places, but you've expanded it to include more Vermont photographs and unpublished photographs.
I really think of myself as a student of region and New England and the construction of the image of New England, as Nathan mentioned, in images and objects and texts and landscapes. There was this real cottage industry from the mid-19th century until about World War II that gave us the image of New England. And what Nathan's project, when he came to Vermont in 1973, what it captures so brilliantly is sort of the end of that era, and then also the beginning of the new, where Vermont in the 70s became a place people came to. And the folks who came in the 70s, we should remember, is a very broad spectrum. These are both, you know, back to the land folks who want to live off the grid and live in a commune, and it's IBM engineers. So it's, you know, Vermont was a haven in the 1970s. People left the city, came here for a variety of motivations. And what I so love about this project is it captures a specific moment in time in Vermont before suburban sprawl, urban sprawl, before Pizza Hut and chain stores came here. This sort of shows us the last of that moment of the invented New England that is Vermont and the beginning of the Vermont of today.
So given that context, Nathan, do you want to show us a photograph and take us inside
Yes.
here?
Yes. I'd like to start with a photograph taken on, I think it was roll one or roll two, the first day of shooting. And it's a photograph taken in Burke Hollow, village of Burke, and it's the Burke town meeting on the first Tuesday of March. I mean, I was there probably for about 3 hours, and I photographed people arriving. I photographed from the outside as people walked to the door. I photographed people getting settled down and people chatting. And then the marshal of the meeting picked up the flag, and the board members stood up and saluted. And I had an aha moment. I said, this has potential. This looks like it should be a photograph. So I hustled up, stood up on a bench, saw this moment, was able to squeeze off about 3 frames. I was so excited that 2 of them are out of focus or blurred. And so I was fortunate to be able to get one moment. And there's only one moment of this scene that really is almost mythical in its sense of reverence, patriotism, solemnity, ceremony, to the extent that when Stern magazine, the dominant German weekly news publication, published their early July issue in 1976 about America's bicentennial. The lead photograph was this photograph because to their audience of Europeans, these fine, earnest, hardworking Yankees holding the American flag in this village town meeting were really the archetype of Yankeeness, a caricature almost.
So, yes, and I mean this as a compliment, but it is sort of Norman Rockwellian in a way.
Yes, and I was aware of Norman Rockwell. I wasn't specifically trying to copy Norman Rockwell, but my image of Vermont, my recognition of the opportunity here was informed certainly by Rockwell and Wallace Nutting and other arbiters of our taste of what Yankees are supposed to look like. Well, these people really did look that way. And, you know, Central Casting could not have done it better. So I have great admiration and appreciation. I'm very fond of these people. And I'm so glad, I feel privileged that I was able to actually witness a scene like this. And I feel lucky that I was able to record it in a 15th of a second.
So juxtapose that with another image. There's one in particular that I've been very curious
Please.
About because I'm not sure what it is. And so it doesn't strike me as, you know, that sort of Vermont. It's a shed, but then there's machinery inside.
This is the roundhouse of the Central Vermont Railroad engine shop.
Aha.
And I don't know if this building survives anymore. I'd kind of be surprised if it did. But it was probably built, I would guess, in the late 19th century, if not the early 20th century. And it had a operating turntable. The locomotives would go in, get serviced, and come out. And I am an old, ever since I was can remember, smallest kid, I was very fond of railroads, and I still am. I continue to be a real railroad nut. So if there's a railroad somewhere, I'd make sure to work it into the story. And I certainly did that. I don't know how many days I spent there, but I had a great time. And in fact, this picture looks in and you see these two monumental diesel locomotives that are being serviced. And this picture is really not about reinforcing an archetype. But this picture is really about design. And I'm glad that it's not instantly identifiable. I think that somebody looking at it would be drawn to it because of design and color and pattern. But I think it could be decoded fairly quickly as being locomotives and railroad wheels.
You know, certainly locomotives and trains, I grew up around them, but not in the same way that people of earlier generations might have. And so that actually isn't recognizable to me. I'm really glad you told me about it because,
really?
You can see that these, they look like sort of giant spools of thread almost in the foreground. But, if you had made me guess, I probably could have gotten there. But no, it certainly wasn't something that I would have picked up on naturally.
Well, this will certainly separate the generations as they view the show. And there are four pictures here taken in this location. It evidences my unreasonable infatuation with railroads. But this picture next to it is a close-up of a mechanic's hands covered with grease. And he's working in the engine shop, and those hands have repaired, no doubt, many, many locomotives, probably going back to steam locomotives. And I think the hands are, they have a roundness to them, and a sensitivity to them, and a fleshiness to them. And that is emphasized by the layer of grease and grime on the fingers.
Tom, let me interrupt because it's really a pleasure to be able to talk to Nathan about the work that's here that you're displaying, but that's not actually a common occurrence at Children's Museum that we actually get to talk to the artist. A lot of your artists are dead or were folk artists, or you don't know necessarily where some of the artifacts came from. What's it like for you to be working with the actual artist as you hang an exhibition like this?
Well, it exponentially sort of opens up our understanding, just because everyone does approach these photographs with different, you know, perspectives and points of view. And I was thinking, what I so love about projects like this is where it presents an opportunity for intergenerational conversation. And I've seen this before, and I know we're going to see it here. We are going to see parents and grandparents explaining Kodachrome to people who have never, you know, thought about film. And I always think it is so meaningful when we're right on the cusp of that change. And Nathan, who was very important to our, you know, our shift to digital technology, you know, I think provides the opportunity for that conversation in this exhibition, Kodachrome Memory. Kodachrome.
That was Shelburne Museum director Tom Denenberg and photographer Nathan Benn discussing a few of the photographs in a new exhibit at the museum. Kodachrome Memory, American Pictures 1972 to 1990 opens this weekend and runs through May. And that does it for today. Tomorrow, should Vermont change the rules of how we elect our governor? In November, no candidate got 50% of the vote, and according to the Vermont Constitution, that means the election goes to the legislature to decide. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at two proposals to change that system. Join us at noon and send your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.